Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. This is Big Ideas. Before I go any further, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that the following discussion contains mention of people who have died. River of Dreams, Anita Heiss's historical novel, features Jackie Jackie and Yari, but the story centres on a young Wiradjuri woman, Wagadine, who survives the Great Flood but is indentured to work for a white family, and as a result is forced to leave her country and her family. Set in the mid-19th century, it's a heart-rending story of courage, loss, and of trying to find your way home. This conversation was meant to take place at the Melbourne Writers' Festival until COVID intervened and the festival was cancelled. But Anita Heiss and I got together for a chat anyway.
Yiradumarung. G'day to you, Paul, and I'm glad we could still have a yarn anyway.
Yeah, me too. So your new book is an historical novel based around real events, real characters. Why did you choose to base the story around the Great Gundagai Flood of 1852 and its aftermath?
Well, it wasn't until the 165th anniversary of the Great Flood of Gundagai in 1852 when they unveiled statues in the main street of Gundagai, that's Sheridan Street, of the two heroes, Yari and Jackie Jackie. And I wasn't in Gundagai on that day, but I watched it all unfold online. My family were there, my family from Wagga, my family from Brungle and Gundagai were all there. And I was watching the news come in and so forth, and I thought, I want all of Australia to know this story. How don't students, how don't everyday Australians know about one of Australia's greatest natural disasters, you know, a flood, great flood that went for 3 days that took the lives of a third of the town of Gundagai? How don't we know about this? And why don't Australians know about our Wiradjuri heroes? And actually, I say Wiradjuri heroes, but essentially they're Australian heroes. They were Wiradjuri men who saved Australian lives, and it's Australian history, so they are Australian heroes. So I had the idea then that I already knew I was writing an historical novel. I'd been commissioned to write a novel, but I didn't have a story as such. I wanted to write a story about women living on the land, on Wiradjuri country, during a period of time in history that spoke to the life experiences of both Wiradjuri women and settler women. But I had no idea where that story would start or end or exist. And then the idea to begin it with the flood happened literally on the 165th anniversary of the Great Flood back in 2017.
Yes, what's particularly interesting is that there is a lot of white folklore around Gundagai. You know, there's that old folk song, The Road to Gundagai. There's the statue of the dog on the tucker box based on that old doggerel poem. Most of us know that. But the story of the heroism of Yari and Jackie Jackie, who I should say saved about 60 people, according to my understanding, using a bark canoe, is one of the most, I've since realised after reading your book, shamefully underappreciated stories. As you say, they built a statue 5 years or so ago. But it is extraordinary that so few of us know this story, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. You mentioned, you know, the song on the road to Gundagai, the dog on the tucker box. And when I speak about this particular story, I ask people in the audience who've heard this, and of course, hands go up. Everybody knows, particularly the dog on the tucker box. And it wasn't until 2019 that a posthumous heroism awards were granted to both Yari and Jackie Jackie. And I will say there were 4 men who went out on canoes during the flood. There was Tommy Davis and Long Jimmy. They did not save lives. But they did go out, and I think that's extraordinary as well, because we're also talking about a period of time when Wiradjuri people were being moved off country, were living under a whole range of legislation that deemed them lesser human beings than settlers. But they, you know, put their sense of humanity first and foremost and went out to save lives. I think for me, when we look at the history of the world, most of it is written by colonising nations, and the way in which the colonisers remember and record history is completely different to the way in which colonised peoples remember and record history. And the recording of history itself is selective and it's subjective, and it's unfortunate for Australians, for you and me, for the generations that have gone before us, who haven't had access to the wealth of stories that still exist that are untold in not only just by about Wiradjuri mob, but about mob the country over. And I think one of the issues is, in terms of the recording of history by settlers, we've either been misrepresented, underrepresented, or not represented at all. And it's one of the reasons I write in this genre. I mean, when my previous novel was Barbed Wire in Cherry Blossoms, and that was about the Cowra breakout. Now, when I realised that, I had a moment when I was at Pearl Harbor where I realised that everything that I had read or seen about the Cowra breakout never mentioned that Wiradjuri men from Cowra went to war, never mentioned that the compound, the prisoner of war compound in Cowra, was 4.5 miles in a direct line from another compound where Aboriginal people, including my mother, lived under acts of protection and assimilation and had less rights than the prisoners of war, who we treated as we should have to the letter of the law under the Geneva Convention. And so I think it's really... It's a slow uptake, but there are more and more people like myself who feel a responsibility and an accountability to use historical fiction, like I have done in Billy Gutter Dungalung Duray, as a means of truth telling in terms of our history.
Okay, so you've given the title of your new novel. It's called, in English, River of Dreams, but that's a translation. You just gave us the Wiradjuri title to the book. And can you just say that title again for us?
I will say it, Paul, and then I would like you to say it, okay? Billa Yadda Dungalung Duray.
Oh, no, I can't do that.
Billa, we're going to do this with your listeners.
Yes.
Billa.
Billa.
Yaruldung.
Yaruldung.
Galung.
Dalung.
Duray.
Duray.
So that translates, and I know your listeners will be doing that at home because they're all fantastic. We're all lifelong learners. Billa means river. Yaruldung is dream. Galung is the plural, so that's many dreams. And Duray is the action, to have the dream. So Billa Yadda Dungalung Duray translates to River of Dreams. But can I tell you this really quick story? Because I'm on my L plates, and everyone kept asking me and texting me, how do you say the title? Can you make a little video? Can you send me a recording? And I did a little Insta post and I put it on Twitter, and there's like thousands of hits overnight, and people are texting me and messaging me online saying, I'm practicing in my car and everything. And then literally 2 days later, Annie-Elaine Lomas, who's one of my language teachers, rings me and says, Bob, I just saw that video. You know you said it wrong.
Oh, no.
And I was horrified, as you can imagine, right? Because one, I wanted to get it right and people were trying. So I was saying Duray instead of Duray. Now, some people say tomato, tomato, whatever, but I wanted to get it right. And so I guess I spent hours that day beating myself up about getting it wrong, you know, and it was pointed out to me by one of my Wiradjuri women that I was studying with. She said, Anita, you are learning what should have been your first language at the age of 50. You are going to make mistakes. And at that moment, I said, yeah, that's right. And it's also a great conversation piece for me to say now. I was embarrassed, but, you know, if I was allowed, if speaking language wasn't outlawed in the day, then my mother would have been a fluent speaker and I would have been learning language as a child.
Yes, and more to the point, you are, of course, reclaiming that language, and using that language in a book. I mean, you're bringing the language alive. Before I come to that, though, I should explain to the listener who hasn't seen the cover of the book that it has alternate covers. On the front cover is the Wiradjuri title. The English translation is on the back. I've not seen that done before, so I thought I'd ask you, was this a radical thing for the book publishers to do, and did they take some convincing to do it?
It is radical. I guess you could say it was radical in the Australian publishing landscape because it hadn't been done before. I will say that my publishers at Simon & Schuster wanted to push the boundaries. They said that was the language they used. We want to really push the boundaries. How can we do that, Anita? How can we tell your story in the best way? And I said, well, if you really want to do that, let's take English off the cover. And they said, great idea. So obviously we put it on the back cover. Most people I know that go into a store, they at least give it an attempt. A lot of booksellers, I've made videos for booksellers and so forth, so that they can do it, because people, I think I'm seeing this new level of respect in not only the publishing industry, but in the bookselling industry and in with our readers. We need to trust that our readers are intelligent and capable and have capacity and want to learn. So, you know, that was a big deal at the time. Mm. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens as we move forward in terms of First Nations literature coming out into the landscape in the next couple of years. The cover itself is quite important to me because it has the image of the goanna, which is the totem for many people in the area that I talk about in the novel, in Wagga and so forth. And that guga, which is the Wiradjuri word for goanna, that image was provided to me by my cousin Lukey Penrith, who lives in Brungle, where some of the story is set. He's a creative, he's an artist and an entrepreneur, and so it was very special for me for him to provide that. We have an actual photo. This is great for radio, I'm giving these visuals, a photo of the Murrumbidgee, but there's also a photo of the, there's also an image of the cockatoo. Mm. And like, I'm a city girl. I was born in Matraville near La Perouse, and, you know, jokingly, Concrete Quarry with Westfield Dreaming. So when I go back to country, it's wonderful, but, you know, it's, and I love it. But when I first got down to Wagga, when I was starting to learn my language, I was staying in the caravan park, and at dusk, and some of your listeners will know, you know, the cacophony that the cockatoos, the sound at dusk when they're just swarms of cockatoos. And I went out of my cabin and I'm videoing it because I'd never heard anything like it in my life. And it's very much part of the landscape of life on the river and so forth. And it features in the novel also as Wagadine's mother's totem. But also, I lost a very good friend of mine. Many of your listeners will have known of Kerry Reid Gilbert, who was a Wiradjuri poet and activist. Her father was the first Aboriginal playwright in Australia with the Cherry Pickers back in 1968. And that was her totem. And I was with her when she took her final breaths. And so I used some of the characters' names in the novel, the Wiradjuri names, are after her grandchildren. So for me, the cover is very important. And you and I both know you can't judge a book by its cover. But I absolutely believe that the cover of any book should speak to the content and the story and the purpose and the meaning and the values that are embedded within the covers.
Well, it's a beautiful cover.
Thank you.
What is immediately distinctive about your book, apart from the cover, is that you drop in Wiradjuri words and phrases from the get-go. It's a crucially important part of how the book is written. You provide a glossary for the reader of the words that you use, which is great. I find you don't need to go to the glossary. You can usually, well, if you've seen the words before, you don't understand what they mean, or you can understand the context. Nonetheless, this was obviously a deliberate decision on your part. Was it always your intention when you decided to write this book that you would use a considerable amount of Wiradjuri language in it?
Actually, no, Paul. When I committed to writing a novel without even having a story, or then having the beginning of the story, I had no idea that I would have Wiradjuri language in the novel. I had no idea that I had the skills at the time to weave language throughout the novel the way that I have. And as you mentioned, the idea is that the reader shouldn't need to go to the glossary, that within the sentence or in the phrase or in the paragraph, they should be able to determine what the word means. So, for instance, there's a scene where the little boy gives Wagadine some clapsticks, and then he kisses her on the cheek from memory and says, Nurubul Nindu, and she says, I love you too. So the idea is that you get from the following sentence, you know, what was being said in language. So what happened was I commit to the novel in May of 2017. The unveiling of the statue is in June of 2017. In January, on January 26, 2018, I flew into Wagga to begin the graduate certificate in Wiradjuri Language, Culture and Heritage at Charles Sturt University. It's the only university in Australia doing, I understand, doing what it's doing. And there's been a number of cohorts of students, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. It's open to everybody. My cohort had a number of non-Indigenous teachers who work and on Wiradjuri country, on land, and have a number of Koori students, and they wanted to be able to teach better. And so they took time out of their working lives to come along.
I'm speaking here with Anita Heiss about her book, River of Dreams. She's talking about learning Wiradjuri.
I feel incredibly privileged to have been in the classroom with Uncle Stan Grant, or Uncle Dr. Stan Grant, I should say, and his proteges, Letitia Harris and Yari Lamshead and Sue Green, who taught and continue to teach Wiradjuri language over it. It's a 2-year certificate. And then we all graduate together, and they're talking about a master's. But it wasn't until I was in that space, it took me some time to stop beating myself up about how difficult it was to learn the language. It's a completely different grammar system. It is not a translation of English into Wiradjuri, because of course there wasn't English when at the point of first contact and invasion. There was only First Nations languages, and so you have to literally de-learn or unlearn English and think in a Wiradjuri headspace. And I remember sitting in my hotel room with every single resource you could possibly have, and we have a lot of resources, which is amazing. Thanks to Uncle Stan and the late Dr. John Rudder, who only passed away a few weeks ago. So condolences to all of his family. But I wouldn't be speaking to you today about this if it wasn't for his work. And sitting there in the hotel room going, I'm never going to get this. And then I realised that, when things slowly fell into place, it became easier. So I'm sitting in the classroom. The classroom is the lecture theatre. It's the seminar room, but it's also the floodplains in Wagga. Mm. It's out on country. It is standing in the Billa, sitting on the riverbank. It's sitting in yarning circles, and it's imagining what it must have been like for my ancestors, because there were floods in Wagga as well. And only when I was sitting in the room, I was texting my publisher at the time saying, I want to do this, I want to do that. And she's like, absolutely, everything, just do it. And so it was a 2-year process of pulling all that together. It was also going down to, I think I went to Wagga about 8 times. I had an enormous amount of support from the library there. People think the knowledge in libraries is all on the shelves. It's a lot of knowledge within the librarians. And so I want to shout out to the librarians there. Gundagai also couldn't have done this without the support of the library there, Cindy and her crew, but also Miriam Crane, who runs the tourism office there. And there is a Yari and Jackie steering committee that put together the submissions for the statue, but also for the Posthumous Heroism Awards. And without their support and their knowledge of the history, like this book never would have happened. Never would have happened. And it wouldn't have happened also if at any point in time anybody in that area, or anybody in terms of my elders in Wagga or Uncle Stan, had said, this is a bad idea. So I ran it by everybody in my class. I spoke to elders about it and so forth, because I don't live on country. I live up here in, sunny Queensland. And it's, yes, I am part of the mob, but I wrote the story also for the people who are descendants of those who drowned in the flood, those who are still survivors of the flood. And I've met family members whose grandparents were rescued by Bayari. And so it's quite a complicated process.
Well, you're talking about respect, actually. Respect for your people, your elders, your culture. And respect is something, and the questioning of respect from white fellas of Indigenous people, some of the themes that come through when you read the book. Just a final question on the language, though, because I think this is so important. I mean, when you write in a language of the First Nations people of this country, it's a political act, isn't it? I mean, we have seen so many of those languages get lost over the centuries since colonisation. Were you conscious of that? And also, I wonder too how the decision to use Wiradjuri language changed the way you told the story, if at all.
Well, I guess for me, I'm a method writer. So with all of my novels, I get into the character's headspace and I imagine what was Wagadine feeling, what was Wagadine thinking, how would she express that, how would her mothers and her aunties express that. And so I think it probably, it did change the impact of the for me telling the story. It was quite an emotional, anxious time for me in terms of writing, more so than any other book that I've ever done before. But also it's an emotional read because for me also speaking language is an act of sovereignty, and we shouldn't say it's a political act. Nobody should have speaking their language be a political act. It's a basic human right that we should have had since, you know, for all time. Mm. The fact that there were, according to the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Islander Studies, 200 distinct languages and 800 dialectical varieties at the point of first contact, and now we have maybe 100 that are active and 13 that are being taught by or learnt by young children. I mean, that is a disgrace, really, in a first world nation where we have resources to make sure we're not losing these languages. And so I think for me, I wanted to tell the story in a way that demonstrated our intelligence, our capacity to adapt, our resilience, our strength, and that meant showing that we had a distinct language. We had ways of describing the landscape, of just talking about love, of talking about the solar system, and, you know, life and so forth. And I'm not fluent. I don't imagine I'll ever be fluent. And for me, this was just a very small contribution to the First Nations literary landscape that I exist in. I mean, it was my 18th book, Paul. Mm. At some point, I needed to get to this place. And if I never wrote another book, I would be confident that this was this had done the job that I had set out to do.
Mm. Yeah, so it feels like a significant milestone, I have to say.
Paul, sorry to interrupt you. Can I just say also, while I remember, just on the language thing, since the book has come out, what I've, you know, and so many people are interested and engaged with the language. So they're reading the hard copy, you know, the paper book, but so many people are actually listening to the audio book that has been done by Tamala Shelton, because they want to hear the living language as well. And I think that's what we're going to see more of in the future. And it's also a reminder, what I want this book to be is a reminder that everywhere Australians walk on this land, there is a first language, and it's not English. Mm. Now, English is the second or third or fourth language of this country. And I think for me, I hope that the conversations that are happening in book clubs and classrooms and wherever are talking about the idea of the need to reclaim and maintain and support the reclamation of language. And it's why the United Nations we had the International Year of Indigenous Languages in 2019, and now we've got the Decade of Indigenous Languages starting in 2022, because that was so successful in 2019 that it became more obvious that more work needed to be done in that space.
Let's talk a little bit about the story, about some of the characters. We'll be careful not to give too much away. The difficulty talking about novels is that you want to give people an insight into what's being discussed without giving the game away. We've already flagged that it's based on the starting point, almost in a sense, is this great flood in Gundagai. And in the opening page of the book, I think, we find out that local Wiradjuri foresaw the folly of building on a floodplain, advised against it. Not a good place to live, boss, too flat, says Yari, which turns out obviously to be prophetic, but which also makes the bigger statement, doesn't it, about us white fellas ignoring the wisdom of the people who have lived on the land for tens of thousands of years.
That's correct. I mean, it's only in recent years where we've seen devastating fires and floods, where Indigenous cultural burns have been taken notice of. You know, this is what we've done for tens of thousands of years. And if it had been allowed to continue and governments, you know, made use of Indigenous knowledge and practices, then bushfires could be prevented. So, as you say, I mean, that's just one element of it. And what we see in the beginning where, and this is documented, where Wiradjuri people, local people had said, do not build here. It will flood. It has flooded previously. It will flood again. And of course, the town was gazetted in 1838. It flooded in 1844. I think two people drowned then. It flooded again, I think, after 1852. And only then was the town repositioned. Now, Wiradjuri people did perform ceremony and did even in terms in the floodplains and so forth, but they knew how the weather worked and they moved when rains started to fall heavy. So I think, you know, back in the day, Aboriginal people weren't thought to have had the same level of intelligence, obviously, as Westerners. And so there would be, you know, there was no recognition, obviously, of Indigenous knowledge and skill then. And one of the things I learnt when I knew this, what became more obvious to me when I was researching the novel and being a method writer, got in a canoe with about 20 other people, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, in Gundagai from Tumut and Wagga. A couple of people came down from Newcastle and we rowed in a tribute to Yardi and Jackie from Gundagai. We went 5 hours south.
Wow.
Downriver.
Up the Murrumbidgee, down the Murrumbidgee.
Down the Murrumbidgee. Mm. And so I wanted to see what it was like, imagine what it was like being on the water, and how difficult it would have been, the element, how afraid people would have been. Now, Paul, you know, the floods happened in the middle of June, middle of winter, icy waters, bark canoes that held one person, and yet they would go and put another person on there. And, you know, 49 times Yardi did that, I believe. Mm. I go out in the middle of summer in a sturdy canoe, life jacket on, blue skies, not raining. I'm not going to drown. I'm surrounded by people. But I did fall in, which I wasn't happy about because I'm a bit competitive and I didn't want to be the one that fell in, but I did fall in. But what that gave me, which was useful, was an element of fear because I was afraid. I didn't know what was going to happen. I'm not a great, I mean, I had a life jacket on and so forth, but it gave me a tiny ounce of an idea of the fear that would have been people who fell in the river. And so what it also taught me was the skill that those men must have had to manage the river in those bark canoes, to get people from trees and roofs and so forth and paddle back to the bank, get the canoe up the bank and get the survivor off the canoe and go back again. You would have to know how the river works and to have not to make to be successful in doing that. And so I think for me that was a great lesson, and that's what I hope that readers also take away from their read of that.
Mm. So I mentioned before the book begins Yarri giving this warning that it's too flat to build, you know, it'll get flooded. You tell the story though essentially the principal character of Yarri's daughter, Wagadine, I think is how you pronounce her name, and she is saved from the roof of the house by her father. We follow her life in the book from a young girl who grows up, begins living with her family alongside the Murrumbidgee, ends up in Wagga Wagga. The story is told from her perspective mostly, and we'll talk a little bit more about the story. But before we do, can you tell me about her? What is it about Wagadine that appealed to you and her perspective, and what did you want to explore with her character?
Yeah, great question. And I'm glad we got into this space because otherwise we would think it was just about the flood. So as you say, the bulk of the story is really told through the point of view of Wagadine. And so for your listeners, Wagadine means dancer, and that's important in terms of her story and her reconnecting back home when she is removed. Without giving too much away, she does go from Gundagai to Wagga with as a servant with the Bradleys under the Masters and Servants Act. And many of your listeners will probably think that Wagga Wagga means place of many crows, which it was promoted as until in recent times. Because the but it actually means Wagga means place of celebration, because Wagga means to dance. Wagga Wagga, obviously, many dances. Wagon is the word for crow. And so we can see when language gets complicated and so forth, that's where people have got Wagga Wagga as a place many crows has come from. Anyway, so for me, the idea was to show life for a young Aboriginal woman who, under the Masters and Servants Act, is living on the land in Wiradjuri country. For me, I wanted to show that Wagadine, for all her distress in being forced to leave her family and go to Wagga with the Bradleys, that she is a strong, intelligent, she's incredibly hardworking, she's a dignified, respectful young woman. She loves her family deeply. She feels an enormous sense of loss and sadness when she's removed from her Mi'kmaq, her family, all her cousins and her brothers and her aunties and uncles. She finds strength in her name, which means dancer, when she can dance. And she recognises that she doesn't have the opportunity to dance and speak her language when she moves to Wagga. And only when she can do those things, those cultural activities, does she feel reconnected to her family. For me, I wanted, and I hope I did it justice, I wanted Wagadine to represent most of the Wiradjuri women that I know today, my elders, my aunties, my sisters, my mum, even the younger women. I'm 53. I keep forgetting that, you know, there's women who are younger than me that are 30 and 40. They're not just teenagers anymore. And I wanted to show through her character and her journey our resilience as Wiradjuri women, and also that we are forced, Aboriginal people generally are forced to become resilient at a very young age. We see this through sorry business in a contemporary sense today. We see incredibly devastating youth suicide statistics, and we see that our young people are forced to become resilient very, very young. And I wanted Wagadine to demonstrate that. But at all times, I see her as an incredibly dignified young woman. She's naive, perhaps in matters of love, but we can speak to that also if you want to. And also I wanted to show the stark difference. There's similarities between her and the settler woman that she works for, Louisa, but there are stark cultural differences, which means in some ways they can never understand each other.
I'm in conversation with Indigenous writer Anita Heiss about her book River of Dreams. We're discussing two of the main characters, Wagadine and Louisa. The relationship with Louisa is a really interesting part of the book, actually. And Wagadine is a great character, as you say, someone. So she is indentured as a housemaid to a settler family of two brothers and one of the brothers' wives. And as you've suggested, as you've alluded to, she is forced to leave her home and go and live in Wagga with them when they leave after the flood. And she's very aware of, well, she's very grateful that she's survived, but she's, and kind of also aware that, you know, in some ways she's lucky, but she's profoundly aware that she is not free as well, mm-hmm. isn't she? And what is particularly interesting, let's talk about Louisa. So she is the wife of one of the Bradleys, a brutal, drunkard, unappealing white fella, if ever there was one. But Louisa is a benevolent white woman of sorts, a type. Talk a bit about their relationship, because this is very interesting.
Well, Louisa is a Quaker. I somebody suggested to me when I was talking about the story when I was on a writing retreat, they said, you know, you should make her a Quaker. I raced home that night, got online and I Googled and I found that the Quakers came to Australia from memory in 1832, that two of their key missions were equality for Aboriginal people and convicts. And I thought that would make her the perfect character for somebody who has, you know, I believe Louisa had morals, she had a good heart, she had ethics, but at the end of the day, she wanted to help the Wiradjuri people, but it was always going to be on her terms. And so there's an inequity or an inequality, an imbalance in that relationship, because Louisa needed Wagadine for pretty much everything. Louisa had lost her own family in the flood. She never speaks of any family back home. She rarely speaks, if ever, of her parents, which is in stark contrast to Wagadine, who speaks of cousins and uncles and aunts and so forth. And Louisa depends on her happiness and companionship from Wagadine, particularly because she has this dreadful husband. But Wagadine needs nothing from Louisa.
Yeah.
You know, she is there because she has to be there. And I see this played out in a contemporary sense, Paul, where there are lots of well-meaning non-Indigenous people who want to do good things, but quite often it's on their terms.
So let's talk about Louisa as a representative of that, because this is how I read her character. In a sense, epitomising the hypocrisy of the benevolent white fella. Intentions are good, and understanding the perhaps bigger picture, bigger moral and equity picture, but really not getting it, really not getting that it's, you know, it's about genuine equality.
Absolutely. And I think with Louisa, look, Louisa wasn't a bad person. I do want to make the point that it wasn't, you know, I read dreadful things that, you know, there were different issues for settler women and Indigenous women, okay? So I'm not portraying her as the bad guy. There is a moment of reflection and an epiphany within herself where she realises she hasn't necessarily fulfilled her goals as a friend or definitely as a Quaker. But there is even today, you know, as I mentioned, in this space, you can have people that want to donate money or they want to do good things, but it'll be tied to this is how we think it should happen. You see it with the government all the time. It's like, we want to do this. This is make it better. We're going to tell you how to do it without listening. Now, Wagadine has, you know, repeatedly wants to go home. That is the one thing that Louisa could have done to demonstrate that Wagadine, as her friend, is her equal.
Yes.
It's going, if you're my equal, you know, it doesn't just mean you have a room with a window and curtains. It doesn't just mean that I get out in the garden with you. It means you can go home whenever you want. That's what being an equal means. So there is still, you know, there's still the power, there's still the control over how business will be conducted and how you will live your life based on what we think is the best thing. Quite often, it's not necessarily what we think is the best thing for you, it's what's the best thing for me. And what the best thing is for Louisa is to have Wagadine there because she has nobody else.
Mm. Look, I think the great achievement of the book, frankly, is that it tells what appears on the surface to be quite a simple story, but the bigger themes are very much present. As I mentioned earlier, the fact that we're ignoring Indigenous wisdom, the flood itself, which seems to me to be a metaphor for this big thing that sweeps through and destroys, perhaps a metaphor for colonisation itself. But Wagadine as a character, I mean, she is not just struggling with the events of her life and the predicament that she finds herself in. She is struggling, isn't she, against the forces of colonialism themselves, her place in that world, the fact that her father is fated as a hero for saving these people in the town, yet he and his mob are denied their land. They get no concrete reward for their efforts. And in fact, after saving all of these people, they get no real effective thanks at all. So she's, in a sense, she's representing this struggle against the bigger historic forces.
And we see her in her quiet times questioning those things, questioning why her father's not being recognised and questioning why, you know, why her people, you know, even though her people have lived for, you know, thousands of years in the elements, why they can't now have blankets and, you know, warm clothes because the white people there have them and so forth. And she's questioning the lack of equality that she's seeing around her. And I think, but also, I mean, my mother and I had conversations when I first started writing about the things that I wrote, and she was concerned that I was saying things about non-Indigenous people. And I realised, and that's because she grew up in a time where we didn't have a voice. You know, she grew up in a time, she was born in 1937 on an Aboriginal mission in Cowra and lived under the Act of Protection and Assimilation and didn't have the rights to even have a voice. And I think what we see with Wagadine and Yari, which is only, you know, 20 years after my mum was born, not even, that they have all these questions, but they know they don't have the right to be forceful about things, they don't have the right to do anything. They can't read and write in English. They don't know that they're told that they're these Masters and Servants Act. They don't know whether that's true or not. I mean, I had a legal team do some research for me, which I'm very grateful for, and they said even though the Masters and Servants Act of New South Wales was not specifically about Aboriginal people and it was meant to protect both the servants and the masters, it is highly likely that Wiradjuri people lived in fear of that.
Mm.
And so I think
that they were enslaved.
Enslaved.
Yeah.
And so people talk about, Aboriginal people were fed rations as payment. Those rations were really paid so that the men had the capacity and had the sustenance to go and do all the work.
Mm.
It wasn't to keep them alive. It was like, we need to feed them rations so that they can go out and drive the cattle or, you know, build the fences, you know, and create and actively participate in fencing off country that was their own.
Yeah. Look, it's a story that in some ways breaks your heart when you read it. But we need to say that it is also a love story because you are a hopeless romantic, it would seem.
And, I am.
And it helps to redeem the story. It helps to create a sense of hope, if you like, because Wagadine falls for Wiradjuri stockmen working on the property in Wagga Wagga. So why, apart from the fact that you're obviously a romantic, why bring the love story element into this story?
Well, I want to show that, you know, we're human beings too. We fall in love. We've been falling in love and making love and having children a lot longer than anybody else on the planet. So I want to show we're humans. We fall in love. We feel fear of rejection. We have a sense of, we want to have a sense of companionship and so forth. And for me, I wanted to show that between Wagadine and Yindjamutta, which is my favourite Wiradjuri word because it means respect and to honour, that their love is born out of a shared culture, a shared sense of belonging to Wiradjuri country, a shared sense of language and of lived experiences, and a shared sense, obviously, of Wiradjuri identity, if I didn't say that already. And I wanted to portray, you know, her black prince as, or sweetheart, we didn't have a word for prince, as Yindjamutta is a composite of all the amazing, incredible Wiradjuri men that I know. My brothers, my cousins, Uncle Stan, all the men I studied with, the men I've known throughout my life. And because I think the media generally, of course not you, Paul Buckley, do a fairly good job of demonising Aboriginal men pretty much every day. And I want the world to see our men the way I see them and the way I experience them in my life as a woman. So their love story for me is also, you know, they have a family, which leads to a greater part of the story where we see Yindjamutta take his sons out on country, where we can, as readers, learn again about the knowledge of the land that Wiradjuri people hold. And, you know, how to behave, how to respect, you know, certain plants and species and so forth. And so for me, I think, like, you know, all my books have a love story. And the Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms was a, you know, there's the Japanese prisoner of war and the Wiradjuri girl living in the hut that my mother grew up in. And because I find for me, I grew up in a house full of love. My father was Austrian, my mother Wiradjuri. And all my sense of humanity was born out of the way I was raised, and I wanted my characters to display that as well. And I just find it easy, you know, hopeless romantic, 53, still believe I'm going to meet Mr. Right. I wanted to, maybe he's listening to this show. I wanted to, it's just an easier way for me to tell a story through that.
I totally get it. I mean, you're talking to another hopeless romantic, no problem at all. And also it helps you, I mean, the book is aimed at a broad audience. It is aimed at, I'm imagining, readers my age and older, but also my kids and younger. So I was curious, what are your aspirations for the audience when they read this book? What would you like them to get out of it? Obviously, some of them will find out about this great historic event that they never knew before. But I suppose this is the question about what are your bolder intentions, perhaps social and political intentions from a book like this?
Well, obviously, you mean specifically, I want them to know about our heroes, of course. We know that. I would hope that readers take away a greater sense of the role our people have played in working the land, a greater understanding of what country means to us. And although we have been forced to become resilient over decades of facing adversity, that we remain a very proud people. And that's not just a Wiradjuri thing. I would say that generally. I firmly believe that when we understand our past, we better understand our present. And Australia is still, I think, coming to terms with the realities of Aboriginal experiences throughout history and how that still plays out today, that we grieve for being off country, the issues around having pride and identity when you may not know where your family have come from because of being moved off country and later policies of removal that created generations of stolen children. There are people who have been who were born out of acts of violence, you know, on the land, and we know that to be true. I hope that the novel also contributes. If we go back to the story of the flood, I hope it contributes to a conversation around the lack of statues that recognise our warriors and our leaders, as opposed to the enormous number of statues that celebrate particularly colonisers and colonial events that do not tell, you know, the full story.
Too many of the wrong statues we seem to have.
Do not include, First Nations peoples and our role in our shared history of this country.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we are hearing many more stories of First Nations people today. This is a great thing. There are high-profile novelists like yourself, like Melissa Lukashenko, Tony Birch, Tara June Winch. They're just a few that come to mind. You know, Bruce Pascoe's book, Dark Emu, read by so many white fellas as well. You said, you've published 18 books now. Do you feel that you're now part of this thriving movement of contemporary First Nations writers in Australia and that this is helping to drive a real change in the national conversation around these matters?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Paul, there's so much going on right now. There's been, I think in the last decade, if we just look at the last 10 years, there's been a renaissance in First Nations writing across every genre. We've seen Black Words, which is a subset of AusLit, grow to 7,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers and storytellers indexed. So across every genre. We've seen the establishment of Black book clubs online, you know, Instagram and so forth, and in person. We've seen the introduction of the Black and Right program through the State Library of Queensland. And that's been the springboard to incredible careers. You know, Nadi Simpson came through that program, Claire Coleman, Jared Thomas, just to name a few. There's been an increase in focused events around our stories and modes of storytelling. There was the inaugural Black and Bright Festival at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne in 2016. I understand that's going to take off again next year. We've seen an explosion of success in the literary award space in nearly all categories nationally, which is just wonderful, not only for individual authors and their publishing careers, but for First Nations storytelling generally, because it puts a focus on our space. In the last 10 years, we've had three Miles Franklin Award winners. We've had Kim Scott with That Dead Man Dance. Mm. He'd previously won it for Benung from the Heart. Melissa Lukashenko won, I think it was 2019, for Too Much Lip, of course, through UQP, and Tara June Winch won for The Yield. Took out, I think, nearly every award there was to take out, Tara took out. This year, I mean, I'm on the board of the University of Queensland Press, and I think it's 45% of what's coming out of our press this year is by First Nations authors. I mean, that's extraordinary. And I think part of that is born out of last year. We know that in June of last year, we saw the world watched the appalling, disgusting, disgraceful public death of George Floyd at the hands of the police in Minneapolis, where we saw an international movement that led to the Black Lives Matter movement. What we saw here in Australia was, for the first time, a recognition that we've had a Black Lives Matter movement here for three decades since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody in the early 90s. And what happened around that time, we were all in COVID, we were in lockdown. I mean, I did march up here with 36,000 other people in Brisbane, masked up, of course. But what we saw was this huge increase and spike in book sales around the country of First Nations authors, of books around race theory, but also books across genres, where for the first time Australians realised that this had been going on in their own country and needed to understand history and so forth. So we've seen in the last 12 months, this increase in interest, but also increase in responsibility, I think, that Australian readers are taking upon themselves to learn, and to learn through a First Nations lens.
I'm going to have to wrap it. It's been a terrific conversation. Thank you very much, Anita, for a terrific conversation.
Mandangu, thank you.
I've been chatting with writer Anita Heiss. Thanks to the Melbourne Writers' Festival, at which this conversation was meant to occur. Anita's book is called River of Dreams. That's the English translation. Or in Wiradjuri, it's called
Biliyaradangalangdurai.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers' Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.